Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. This time around, we've got a special treat for you. On November 3rd, Reason Magazine's editor-in-chief Catherine Mangu Ward and I debated Vivek Chibber and Bhaskar Sankara of Jacobin Magazine in New York City. The proposition under discussion was, is capitalism the best way to improve standards of living, ensure political and economic freedom, and provide opportunity? Or could socialism do better? The event was held in Cooper Union's Great Hall, a historic venue probably most famous for Abraham Lincoln's famous anti-slavery speech, and the debate was moderated by the New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg. About 900 people were in attendance, and if I'm being honest, almost all of them were hostile to capitalism and Reason's arguments in favor of free minds and free markets. At least that's the way it seems sometimes from the stage. Without further ado, here's Capitalism, a Debate.
Hi, thank you all so much for coming out on a Friday night. We are here to debate the proposition, capitalism is the best way to improve standards of living, ensure political and economic freedom, and provide opportunity. And the reason that I was intrigued when Bhaskar asked me if I wanted to do this is because I'm sort of persuadable on this issue. I grew up or came of age at a time when it seemed as if alternatives to capitalism had been completely discredited. And I think it's hard to remember or hard to understand if you weren't around then how much it seemed as if there was really no alternative. It kind of didn't matter what you thought of capitalism, just like it doesn't really matter what you think of human mortality. It was an inevitable fact of life after the fall of communism. And I would imagine that if you are coming of age now, it seems that just as communism had failed, capitalism has now failed. We're governed by this cabal of comic book villain oligarchs, while people are forced to wear diapers at their factories because they aren't given bathroom breaks. And even the one thing that you used to be able to say for capitalism, which was that it was supposed to be efficient at allocating capital, is clearly not true at a time when, you know, wages are stagnant while, you know, tens of millions or hundreds of millions are invested in kind of fantastical Silicon Valley startups. And so I'm interested in this debate. I'm interested in to see if either side can talk me out of my sense of despair and total futility. And I'm grateful to Cooper Union for giving us this historic great hall to have this debate in. It was originally scheduled for a different venue and sold out very quickly. And I think it's, you know, testament to how much hunger there is for intelligent political debate that all of you are here. This is home to a tradition of political debate going back to 1860. When Abraham Lincoln made a major anti-slavery address in this very place. And thank you to thank you to Haymarket Books, who are operating the sales outside of the hall. Thank you to thank you to Verso Books and especially Fan Nguyen for providing live stream services so that this debate can reach people beyond this room. And let me explain how this is going to go. We have a number of kind of formal questions that everybody that we've talked about beforehand, people will have 3 minutes on each side to address them, and then 2 minutes for rebuttals so that I don't have to kind of talk over people and try to bring these segments to a close. Their mics are going to cut out when those when their time is done to kind of keep it moving fairly briskly. Then we'll move into a more informal discussion. and there are not going to be audience questions, which I hope doesn't disappoint people who were very excited to hear to hear a long autodidactic disquisitions. And so let me introduce our panelists. Nick Lesby is editor-in-chief of Reason and Reason TV. I'm sorry, editor of Reason.com and Reason TV, the online platforms of Reason. And Catherine Mank Ward is editor-in-chief of Reason and a future tense fellow at New America. And Vivek Chibber is a professor of sociology at New York University. And and a person with a very active fan base, and the editor of Catalyst, a journal of theory and strategy. His latest book is Postcolonial Theory and the Specter of Capital. And and Bhaskar Sankara is the founding editor and publisher of Jacobin and the editor of the Agency for Socialism. And so we're going to begin by trying to define our terms. And so the first question, which is we're going to start with Reason, is what is capitalism?
Thank you very much, Michelle. And thank you very much to Jacobin for organizing this debate. When they reached out to us, we immediately thought this is going to be a delightful time. So I hope you enjoy yourselves as much as we do. So definitional questions, incredibly annoying, sort of pedantic. Let's go ahead and get it out of the way. Capitalism is a system that doesn't have any answers. It does not seek to impose answers to the question, what should we produce? How should we produce it? Who gets the stuff we produce? Now, that kind of sounds like some airy-fairy garbage, so I'm going to try and get a little more nitty-gritty also in my answer. What that means in practice is that property is largely privately owned. It means that profit provides incentives for production. It means employment is at will. It means the government's role in the economy should be strictly limited, and the forces of supply and demand in a free market, while imperfect, are the most efficient means of providing for the general well-being of humankind. Now, I'm mostly going to obsess about that last point. My colleague Nick Gillespie will be hitting on some other topics, but I am just going to keep coming back to this idea, the question of whether or not capitalism, in fact, lets people flourish, whether it provides the best life that we can possibly provide for them. Now, a couple of points here. Between 1990 and 2010, we have had the most incredible revolution. Michelle's introduction expressed despair. I rarely find myself on the side of cheery optimism, but I'm going to give it a go here and say that in those 20 years, we took the number of people living in extreme poverty and cut it by 50%. We did the same thing for the number of people who don't have access to clean drinking water. Now, what happened in those 20 years? Oh, I know, capitalism. That's what happened. Capitalism came to India and China. And the version of capitalism that came to India and China is wildly imperfect. It doesn't look anything like the version of capitalism that I would like to see in the world. But it looks enough like capitalism to have generated this huge boom in standards of living. I think when Americans talk about capitalism, we can be a little myopic. We can think about what our capitalism looks like right now. That's a different question than what capitalism, the idea, looks like and what capitalism looks like in the world at large. Note here that neither Nick nor I are fans of big business. That is not what we are here to argue. We're not here to argue for crony capitalism. We are not here to argue for, the fusion of big business and big government. We do not like those things. But we do want to talk about how things really exist in the world. I am sure that the gentleman from Jacobin would like to disavow how socialism sometimes plays out in the world. Probably, maybe all the ways that socialism plays out in the world. So let's talk about the real world, but let's keep in mind that we have an ideal vision of capitalism as well.
Okay, thank you. Jacobin.
What capitalism is an economic system fundamentally. Now, my colleague said capitalism doesn't have any answers. That's Exactly, I think, right. It doesn't have any answers to most of the problems the world is facing today. What it is a system fundamentally organized around exchange, around trade, around money, around commodities. And in particular, capitalism is organized around the purchase and sale of labor power, around the purchase, that is to say, wage labor. And it's the first system in the world where work has been fundamentally carried out by people who are working for a wage. In the United States today, and in the world, any part in the world that we call capitalist, the fundamental, the modal form of labor is wage labor. In this country right now, anywhere between, depending on how you measure it, 65 to 70% of the population are wage laborers. Now, on the other side of this is a group of people who own the means of production. And these, we call them capitalists. And this is a tiny percentage of the population. Now, when we say own the means of production, it actually means two separate things. Either it's direct ownership of the means of production or effective control. So a CEO, for example, technically is a salaried employee, but we're going to call them a capitalist because what they do is they make all the decisions that an owner would typically make. Now, in between these, we have a population of, in the United States, about 20, 25, 30% of the people, again, depending on how you measure it, who we would call middle class. This would be people who are managers, people who are white-collar, high-level salaried people, or owner-operators, ma-and-pa shops, people who have their own engineering, people who are graphic designers, things like that. The essence of capitalism, everything we know about it, revolves around the relationship between the first and the second group of people, the wage laborers and the capitalists. Now, we're going to ask the question, is this a system that is the best possible means for improving standards of living, for providing opportunities, et cetera? It's a hard question to answer because when we say best possible for socialists, you're comparing it against two things. You're comparing it against a system that today, and I hope we will all agree on this, a system that today nobody supports, which is the Soviet-style or Chinese-style system of socialism. On the left today, people don't support it. On the right, that's usually used as a straw man to knock down socialists when they're saying we want a different system. The argument comes, so that's what you want. And I just want to stipulate right now for the rest of the conversation, neither I nor Bhaskar would support that system. Now, a second alternative to which we compare it is the improvements that have been made within capitalism, improvements that push it in a socialistic direction, but without going whole hog into public ownership of the means of production. The reason most socialists embrace those sorts of systems is because they're driven by the same principles.
Thank you.
You know, the first thing that I want to say, Michelle, is I didn't realize when you were talking about working conditions that the New York Times requires its people to work at their desks and wear diapers. I thought that only happened in the third world, but
well, it happened. Yes. I mean, but it clearly doesn't happen in the third world.
I realize many of your many of the people at the New York Times are that old, but we'll let that pass.
I mean, obviously, if everybody in this country had the working conditions at the New York Times, capitalism wouldn't be up for debate.
Yeah, well, yes. There would be a revolution, right? I want to pick up on something Vivek said, where he said that capitalism is an economic system. I want to stress, actually that capitalism is a subset of a larger liberal political philosophy that I suspect that the Reason people and the Jacobin people and a lot of the people in this audience actually agree on, which the very way that we're talking about this question, does the individual, how does the individual fare under a particular political, economic, or social system? Capitalism is simply the application to economics of a kind of classical liberal theory that goes back at least to the 17th century, and it's really all about centered around the individual and increasing and maintaining autonomy for individuals. And the way that I think about capitalism the world and the liberal philosophy from which I tend to defend capitalism was best summed up a few years ago by a Canadian politician named Tim Moen, who ran under the slogan, unsuccessfully, I might add, after all, he was in Canada, but he said, I want my married gay friends to be able to defend their pot plants with guns. And that's, in many ways, is what Reason's vision of capitalism is about. It's about securing basic rights to live and to explore and to express yourself, to participate in what John Stuart Mill, an economist, a political economist who straddled on the one hand libertarian ideas as well as socialist ideas about running experiments and living. So that's what we're defending when we talk about capitalism.
Thank you. And you guys get you get the last word on this question.
I'm glad you said that, Nick. Actually, we couldn't agree more. Socialists and people on the left for generations have fought for those very rights. And the reason we have those rights today is because of the left. It's important to understand that the liberties that that libertarians embrace are liberties that were not bequeathed or bestowed upon the population by the elites who took power in the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century. What those elites put in place everywhere and always was oligarchies, narrow a political system ruled by the rich for the rich. The extension of civil and political liberties everywhere and always came about through fights and struggles of trade unions, working people, of all colors and of all genders. Now, so that's a baseline that we can all agree on. What in the rest of the debate, what I'm going to be trying to establish along with my colleague over here, is that the problem with capitalism is not that it's based on the principles or the philosophies that our colleagues here are talking about. The problem with capitalism is that it cannot possibly deliver on them. And this is what we're going to try to establish from now.
Okay. So to return to Jacobin, our first question is, I bet I know how you're going to answer it, is the profit motive a force for good?
Well, maybe I'll surprise you, Michelle. No. Well, now, in a limited way. Look, what I said earlier, what capitalism is a system that's based on market exchange. That's a little bit misleading. What capitalism fundamentally is a system which structurally compels firms and owners of capital to constantly maximize profits. At the center of capitalism is a blind, relentless pursuit of profits. It's a compulsion. It is not a profit opportunity. It is not an entrepreneurial spirit. It is a compulsion. And everybody understands this. In capitalism, if firms don't maximize profits, they die, or at least they risk death. Now, this has a very important consequence, and it goes straight to the question of freedom and autonomy, which our colleagues are promoting. Because in capitalism, for the vast majority of the population, there is no choice but to offer up their labor services for a wage. They have to go out and seek employment. The employer who hires them is an entity for whom the only thing that matters and the only thing that can matter is not just acquiring, but maximizing their profits. Now, this results in two things. First of all, for the worker, they have to, when they take the wage bargain, what comes with the wage bargain is an agreement that for the 8, 9, 10 hours, or if the 19th century, 12 hours, or if it's the third world today, 14 hours, for that period, I surrender my autonomy to you. That is part of the wage bargain. I pee when you tell me to. I talk when you tell me to. I stand where you tell me to stand. Furthermore, you get to set the wage level. It's not just that inside the workplace, the boss gets to tell me what to do. It's that because he has the power to set the terms of the wage bargain, the boss also gets to decide what the level of the wage is. He gets to decide what time I come in, what time I leave. Now, understand this. It has two very important consequences. It means that, first of all, income distribution in capitalism is set by people who run the firms, by the CEOs, by the managers. That means that their power, their bargaining power, sets what they're going to get out of it. And that's why in the last 45 years, what we've seen in the United States is that while productivity in manufacturing and the economy has gone up by about 78%, real wages for production line workers, for ordinary workers, have actually stagnated. They've gone up about maybe 6%. For the bottom 50% of the population, all of which is working class, there has not been a rise in their wages in 40 years. Okay, that's a consequence of their lack of freedom. Secondly, it means that for the 10 hours they're at work, they are unfree. And for the time that they leave work, now they spend the rest of that time getting ready to come back to work again. Yes, that they have a choice who to work for, but the whole point is whoever they work for, that's the bargain that they get.
Thank you.
Did you hear that little bit right at the end? Yes, they have a choice who they work for, but that's my whole point here. That's what I'm going to dwell on. People have choices. People have choices when they take a job. They have choices when they buy an object. They have choices when they engage in any kind of commercial transaction. Where people don't have choices is when they deal with government. And to my mind, one of the strongest cases for capitalism is when we carve out space that is voluntary transactions. I absolutely agree. Self-expression, individual autonomy, these are the goods that we're seeking. But I think it's quite clear that in the case of the modern American market economy, where people are living free lives is not it is not only outside of their work lives. We've heard a lot about the working class. We've heard a lot about the capitalists. I hope we get to hear about the bourgeoisie later.
If you want.
And what I want to emphasize here is that, as the kids these days say, everybody in this room is pretty bougie. We are all benefiting from the seeming excesses of the modern capitalist system, which is indeed driven by profit. Profits are information, just like prices are information. And what profits and prices tell us is when we are making the right amount of stuff for the people who want it, the people who are going to voluntarily buy it. It tells us when people are in jobs that they are willing to do for the wages that they are offered. And this is, I think, something that is constantly lost in this debate. The idea that people are somehow coerced in their working environments simply isn't the lived experience of workers in America at any level. This is not to say that people love their jobs and just bounce in there every day full of unicorns and rainbows. That's how I feel about my job. That is not how most people feel about their jobs, maybe. But this is still ultimately every morning you wake up and you have the decision about whether or not you're going to go to work. You can choose not to go. And the day that you choose not to go is, you know what happens to you at that point? Nobody comes to take you away. Nobody comes to arrest you. Under socialist systems, historically, that is in fact what happens. And I think that this is something that our friends on Team Jacobin would like to erase, deny, pretend doesn't exist, and I absolutely will grant them that that is not the ideal form of their system. It is, however, the lived form of their system. Under capitalism, we have a constant, ongoing push for profits, which leads to all the riches that you currently enjoy. It leads to the fact that you could pay your $5 or $10 for the ticket for this event. It leads to the Uber that you took here. It leads to the phone that you're texting on right now and probably tweeting about how I'm an evil capitalist.
Thank you.
All right, so let's start with the question of choice. Is it the case you wake up every morning, you wonder whether you're going to go to work or not? Well, for me, it is. So screw the rest of you. And that's capitalism. It's a great system if you're on top. There's never been a better system if you're on top. But the fact of the matter is, for the people who actually are people who work for a living, here's the expression they use, I have to work for a living. There is no choice in capitalism about whether or not you're going to go to work. This is no small thing. It is because there is no choice about whether or not you're going to go to work that you submit to the power, the authority, and quite often the depredations of your employer. I think it's just somewhat disingenuous to suggest that when people go to work, they face an open playing field for themselves. What they face is an employer whose sole prerogative, whose sole goal is to do two things. Pay out as little as they can, and to get as much work out of the workers as possible. Now, is this a bastion of freedom, and is it a bastion of opportunity? Not really. Yeah, it's true that it's better than being a slave. It's true that it's better than being a serf. It's true that it's better than being in a state socialist society. But are those the choices we want to put before our kids? Are those the choices on which we want to hang our philosophy of life and the way we organize our societies? It is absolutely true that the state socialist systems were abominations, but we have done much better even within capitalism, and every time we've done better, it's been by reining in the power of employers, by increasing the power of workers, and by giving people access to the basic necessities of life without the market.
So the next question goes to Reason. Can freedom exist without private property?
Yeah. Let me get to that in a second. One thing, sequel here. Vivek is talking as if negotiation and trade and change and improvement in circumstances is somehow antithetical to capitalism or liberal philosophy of which capitalism is an economic application. He's totally wrong. As Joseph Schumpeter wrote in 1942, the capitalist achievement does not typically consist in providing more silk stockings for queens, but in bringing them within reach of factory girls. We live in a world that is overflowing with crap, with things to buy, opportunities to have, and freedoms to indulge in. It may be among the working class in fetishizing Brooklyn youth that's not a problem, but that's what is happening. We have more things and more opportunities than we ever have in the United States. The cost of virtually everything that you want to buy that is not completely regulated or priced by the government, such as healthcare and education, has been getting cheaper in terms of the amount of work that needs to be produced in order to purchase it. A car, a refrigerator, a television set, a cable package, an internet connection. It goes on and on. In the developing world, there is not a place in the developing world where things are not getting better when trade and commerce or capitalism increases. 3 out of 4 adults in America are better off than their parents were at age 40, even though we have had a shitty economy for all of the 21st century. We're still doing better throughout the world. As Catherine was talking about, extreme poverty has been more than halved in the past 25 years because of trade, not because of aid and not because of giveaways by states to corrupt dictators around the globe. Now the question is, can you, property absolutely essential, or can freedom exist without private property? I would say no, because the starting point of this system, and I don't think this is a question for socialism either, it begins with the individual and it begins with a concept of self-ownership. And it begins very clearly and very profoundly with the right to say no, that you are not going to do something. And it's a cheap applause line, to be honest, to say, working for a living, well, it's better than slavery. It is quantitatively better than slavery. It is qualitatively distinct from slavery as well. And it is wrong, particularly in an advanced economy or any in the U.S., in Canada, in Mexico, in any of the OECD countries, to try and blur those lines. Because we do have options, and we own ourselves, not completely, not fully, but we own ourselves, and in that is the beginning of liberal philosophy and capitalism as it plays out in the world, which makes us richer and better off.
Okay, thank you.
I was hoping I wouldn't have to speak tonight. I would just be like hanging in the back of the music video or whatever. In most of my self-conception, I'm something like a Shug Knight-like figure, so don't burst my bubble. I think self-ownership is a great way to put it. And in that respect, do we have freedom today? Yes, we have some freedom, but it's an unnecessarily limited freedom. It's a freedom mostly enjoyed by the small group of people who own private property. The rest of us are at these people's mercy. And I'm not talking about, obviously, personal property. I'm not talking about your ownership of a toothbrush. I'm not talking about Nick's leather jacket. He got it at a Dead Kennedys concert in 1982, and I would die for his right to keep it. But private property is different. Those are the things that give the people who own them power over those who don't. Take a privately owned workplace. Business owners get to impose working conditions that, if given a good alternative, most people would reject. And while workers do most of the work at a job, owners have unilateral say over what happens to the profits afterwards. This is something we were driving home, and I think is a simple point. I think it's a point that even libertarians shouldn't reject if they're thinking their conception of self-ownership seriously, and that's that work or starve is not a fair bargain. Economic relations aren't free and private if they're contracts made under duress. Their contracts that we have today are contracts that undemocratically give some people tremendous power over others. Now, if you want to talk about concrete historical examples, let's do that. Let's look at even existing societies like Europe's welfare states, places where private property has been undermined through the regulation of capital. Those societies, to some degree, limit freedom for the people who own private property. But for the majority who don't, these people enjoy a greater range of choice and a greater chance to achieve their potentials. They have this freedom not because private property is upheld, but because the freedom for the minority who own private property is limited. Fundamentally, socialists believe in the rights of people to the fruits of their own labor. Of course, we believe in individual rights and individual freedoms, but our individuality can only be achieved in a society truly embodying the virtues of liberty and of solidarity. And of course, you know, we believe in a system of law. We just believe in different law. Ending private property isn't just about government taking things. We don't want an all-powerful government bureaucracy, but we also don't want big corporate bureaucracies to control our society either. Social and economic decisions must be made by the people whom they most affect. Libertarians can't go far enough to embrace a more expansive vision of freedom. They can't go far enough to truly embrace the self-ownership that Nick was talking about.
Thank you. Here, reason you get the last word.
The idea that we get to define private property as the property that seems kind of yucky and we don't like, and we have to put all the cool stuff that we really do like in a different basket of personal property, I think is a fundamental misunderstanding of how those two things are very, very tightly interrelated. If you like your stuff, if you like to be able to do what you want to do in your home, in your car, on your computer, this is all enabled by private property. If we're talking about civil liberties, they exist because we have spaces carved out where people not only own their own bodies, but also own the physical space around them. They own the media in which they communicate. This is more true than ever. It turns out that capitalism, as it exists in the world, does not result in a narrowing of the channels for communication, say. Let's talk about free speech as an example. It turns out that greedy corporations actually have made it incredibly easy, have proliferated the ways for people to get together, shout at each other, express their opinions, do what they want to do. That is predicated on our understanding of where the lines of free speech start and stop. They are different in public spaces and private spaces, and speech is freer in private spaces. This is something that you can tell by the fact that when you look on a corporate-owned platform of any kind, you will see people shouting full time about how awful corporations are. That strikes me as evidence that corporations are not, in fact, constantly suppressing expression or personal liberty. Furthermore, I just want to say that private property as a precondition for political liberty does not, again, mean businesses get to be in charge of the government. That is the opposite of the thing that we are talking about here. The moment when big business and big government get together, the socialists lose, the libertarians lose, everyone loses. That is not what you're advocating for, but it is in fact the inevitable end game of socialism as it is proposed by the Jacobin gang.
Thank you.
Okay, so the next question, what is the relationship between freedom and democracy?
Capitalism.
Between capitalism and democracy.
So this is a historical question. And I think we should be very clear about the answer to this question. Capitalism has everywhere and always fought against the implementation of democracy and the expansion of suffrage. No need to clap. That's a sad thing, and it's historical fact. And once we got democracy, capitalism has worked to undermine it, to make sure that the power it has or potentially could have is hemmed in. Capitalists don't want to give up power to democratic processes. They don't want to deal with engaged and empowered voters. Why were capitalists so worried about working in democratic societies? You know, it's simple. They thought that if working people could express their political rights, they wouldn't just stop there. They would extend democracy into economic and social realms too. Capitalists actually underestimated how resilient their system is. We do live in a democratic capitalist society, a society that has been made more civilized. But as Vivek said earlier, this is because, precisely because of the struggles of working class movements and despite the resistance of capitalists. The fact is, we still live in a partial democracy, not a complete democracy, and that's just because of how much of our time we spend in our workplaces. A few CEOs make decisions that affect millions of people, and this tyranny bleeds over into other spheres of life. Even if you were to say, okay, the tyranny of the workplace is fine, it can be justified, but we want democracy elsewhere, it doesn't work that way. It has been consistent that the economic power of capitalists have undermined our political democracy. And whatever noble liberal dreams we share of liberty and justice has been frustrated by how wealth and power is distributed and because of how dumb democratic capitalists are. If we were to go forward, if we were to try to achieve a deeper democracy, an economic democracy, the kind that would allow the majority to win and live in freer and happier lives, we would see capitalists once again as a barrier to that advance. We've seen it everywhere. This, to me, is history. So the only recourse they have is to defend this history and say that the inroads against democracy were justified, or go on. But this libertarian temptation to both trumpet the economic power of democracy but still play lip service to democracy, I think, is unsustainable.
Yeah. Maybe it's worth defining what we mean by democracy. Democracy is majority rule. How many of you are Republicans? And how many of you want absolute democracy now that the Republicans own the White House and both houses of Congress? Anybody out there? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Because this whole idea that democracy is somehow an absolute good is bullshit. And we all know that. And the signal achievement of the past 500 years in Western political philosophy has been limiting the state to say that there are certain things that the state does not own of you or from you or because of you. We all believe in fettered democracy. Nancy McLean recently wrote a book called Democracy in Chains about how the evil Koch brothers are going to thwart democracy. I should point out that the Koch brothers are donors to Reason, and thank God, because we believe that there are individual rights, including a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that a majority of Donald Trump Republicans can vote to take away from the rest of us. So let's get that straight. Democracy is not an unfettered, unalloyed good. In fact, it's deeply problematic. There is a wide range of shared activities on which a majority can vote, and we can decide this or that within a certain range. But nobody wants unfettered democracy. That's mobocracy, and I think we're all against that. The question then is, what is the relationship between capitalism and democracy? To the extent that there are social goods that we agree that we want to fund, and if you're a liberal, a libertarian in today's parlance, a classical liberal in eras past, that might be something like public education. I won't speak for Catherine because as libertarians, we are not allowed to speak for each other. I'm not even allowed to always speak for myself because I usually am not quite sure what I think about something. But say, take public education. That's something where we might tax people. We're not going to take all their income, but we tax people and then give it to people who will benefit from an education so they can participate more fully in society, develop themselves, have more autonomy, etc. Okay, let's do that. It doesn't need to be absolute. We need tax money. You get tax money from markets and commercial transactions of things that people actually want, as Catherine was talking about. So capitalism, or the economic application of liberal political philosophy, gives you the money that you can then use in taxes to help people participate more fully in society. that's not such a bad thing. And then we might argue in terms of, and I know that one thing that's good about Jacobin is that they're market socialists, so they might say public education would be better if it was based on charter schools or schools of choice within a system rather than mandatory schools that are a lot like prisons.
Okay.
For the record, this was otherwise a friendly conversation, but that last part was just libelous. So it is funny that Nick mentioned the Koch brothers, and I appreciate the disclaimer. But does anyone know where the Koch family got rich? Especially because Catherine has brought up the specter of Stalinism and socialism practice a little bit. The Koch brothers got rich making deals in Stalin's USSR. That was part of not the Koch brothers themselves, but part of the family wealth was derived from there. So the time when the anti-Stalinist left was denouncing in the late 20s and 30s Stalinism, we shouldn't forget how Ford and a lot of big U.S. capitalist interests were very happy to drop their ideology and do business where they could. Now, let's take the example of public education there. Now, if they're conceding that, and I actually do agree, most conservatives in this country, most libertarians in this country would concede that a child has the right to be literate, learn basic mathematics, and you know it's really unequal, but we do have public education in this country. It's decommodified, it's taken out of the market in this country. Now, if they have this right as a social right, then what's more fundamental than housing or than them having three meals a day? Isn't that even more fundamental than education? So that's, why don't we enjoy all those things as social rights? As far as democracy, I just want to once again stress that of course we believe in bedrock social and civil rights. Of course we believe in the rights of minorities. The question for us is just how to take those paper rights and turn them into a reality. That's why socialists, and the historical record is very important for American socialists. We fought for the 8-hour work week, for struggles for women's suffrage, civil liberties for African Americans, reproductive rights, the fight for gay marriage, and on and on. And again, this is our history, this is our legacy, and this is what our actual relationship to democracy in practice.
Okay, now... This is the last question for the formal part of the debate. Does capitalism allow people to reach their full potential?
So for me, this one seems easy. It's having access to resources that allows people to reach their full potential. And as you've just heard, the Jacobin folks would say, well, the way that we get people access to basic stuff they need is socialism. We fight against the capitalist system to shuffle all the stuff around until people have the minimum they need. In fact, though, I will come back to the same old song I've been singing all along, which is that in the last 25 years, there has been a spectacular, unprecedented, mind-blowingly large growth in the number of people who have access to the basic stuff they need to self-actualize. And I don't think anybody in this room would disagree that if there is any economic system that has been dominant during that period, it's capitalism. This is like just a very, very fundamental fact which plays to our point of agreement. People need stuff to do what they want to do. And capitalism generates stuff. It generates more stuff for the richest people, the people who control capital, no doubt. But it also generates an incredible amount of stuff for the poorest people. And I think that what you will always hear in these debates is the inequality point. Not irrelevant, totally important, absolutely important, particularly from the political perspective, because people respond to what feels fair. At the same time, the poorest people, while the gap between them and the richest people is growing, the poorest people are getting richer at a spectacular rate. So if your premise is simply that to self-actualize, to flourish, people need to have some basics and then they can go out and do their thing, capitalism is the best way to provide those basics. And I think that everything else is essentially clouding the issue. If we have private property, people have their own space and their self-ownership to do what they want to do. If we have capitalism, even in the garbagey, imperfect way that it exists in the world, people are rich enough to get a hold of the basics. The amount of people's income that they spend on food, for instance, has plummeted dramatically. The amount of people's income that they spend on housing has plummeted dramatically. I know it doesn't feel like that in New York City, but it is in fact a global truth. It's also an American truth. And I think that this is something that it's so easy to gloss over, which is why I just want to say it over and over like a lame broken record. People have enough money to buy their basic stuff. And there is no amount of hand-waving and talking about the workers and talking about the capitalists that can make that untrue. And the idea that we are looking for something else for self-actualization is totally misguided. People should be able to choose what their own best life looks like. The maximizing of the area for personal choice absolutely starts with providing the basics, and that's what capitalism does.
The answer is no, it can't. This is my time you're taking up. Look, a couple of factual issues here. I want to respond to two factual issues quickly, but Nick and Catherine brought up. This idea that in the last 15 years, there's been a massive decrease in poverty rates around the world. This is really driven by China. It's a little bit misleading. I don't want to be the pointy head professor here, but it's a little bit misleading what they're saying. And China is a country in which 50% of the revenue is still controlled by the state. If that's your vision of capitalism, it's not quite where you want it to be. Secondly, this is more important. Catherine and Nick, you cannot be serious when you're talking about the United States. Nikki said 3 out of 4 Americans are better off right now than they were, 30 years ago? Absolutely untrue. Catherine, you're saying that even maybe outside in New York, it seems misleading, but outside the country, even in the last 20 years, the poor are better off? Absolutely untrue. We're living through the first period in history in the last 40 years in the United States. The bottom 50% of this country has not seen its wages or its income rise. And this is Raj Chetty from Stanford. This is Piketty. This is Emmanuel Saez. Study after study after study is showing this. Why does that matter? Nick says, we think on the Jacobin side that capitalism doesn't have bargaining. Quite the contrary. It absolutely has bargaining. The point is the bargain itself between employer and employee is what's resulted in the stagnating incomes for the bottom. Why has it resulted in that? Because their trade unions, the supporting institutions from the state have been dismantled. And so now what we have is a complete despotism of the employers. This is not an aberration. This is capitalism. This is what you get when you take away the supports for working people. Now let me address the question very directly. Does capitalism maximize people's chances for developing their capacities? Yeah, if you're on the top, if you're wealthy. But for the rest of them, no. And there's 3 reasons. Just think about this commonsensically. What does it take for you to develop your capacities? Well, it takes 3 things. Autonomy. You should have the freedom, as my colleagues are saying, to decide what you want to do. Time to develop them. And in the end, money. All right. For the bulk of the working time of a working American, they are presiding in a tyranny. A private tyranny, which is called the workplace. By the way, this Catherine, you said that civil liberties are enhanced wherever there's private property. You can't be serious. The one place in America where you do not have full rights of speech is in the workplace. The place where that is the essence of private property. If you want to organize a union, you're fired. You want to talk when we told you not to, you're fired. You want to go take a piss when we told you not to, you're fired. These are called employment rights, and these are encroachments of people's autonomy. No autonomy there. Secondly, time. Do you know 83% of Americans today feel that they're stressed? Why are they stressed? Underpaid, overworked. Overworked means you are killing yourself at work, and what happens when you're away at home? You're simply recovering to go back to work. What autonomy? What flourishing?
Thank you.
So here's a question, and as Catherine pointed out and has underscored, and I agree with completely, we're not talking about perfection, capitalist perfection right here and now versus a socialist paradise. We're talking about, I'm not a religious person, but I believe in original sin, and we live in a fallen world. China is more capitalist than it was 15 or 20 years ago. It has a fuck ton long way to go to where it would even be similar to living in Mississippi. But to the extent that it's more capitalistic, fewer people there are starving to death. That is also true in the continent of Africa, where between 2000 and 2015, two-way trade between the United States and Africa more than doubled, and the extreme poverty rate, which is generally defined as living on $1.90 or less for purchase power parity, has massively declined because it's more capitalistic than it was. There is more commerce, there is more trade. There is more goods that I own that I sell to you, and you buy and you sell me something back. What I said was that if you look, and this is scholarship done by Scott Winship, drawing off of the panel survey of income dynamics, it is not controversial in the field of income mobility. 3 out of 4 people, by the time you turn 40, you are doing better off than your parents were. It's an old song, and it's a really nice song to keep saying, this is the first generation in America that will live at a lower rate than before. Think about it yourself. When's the last time you bought a TV? And when is the last time you paid more in dollar amounts, not accounting for inflation or better features or anything? Things have been getting cheaper and cheaper in nominal dollars, and also in the amount of work that the average worker has to do in order to do it. So things are getting better. Where they need to get better still is to remove restraints on individual rights, so we're not locking people up for nonviolent drugs and things like that. A lot of it place for improvement, but economic stagnation is not actually what we're talking about here.
Okay, so now we're going to move into something a little bit more informal. And what I want to know of Reason, is it your position that just because capitalism has given us, as you said, a world overflowing with crap, that the inequalities that creates, you know, the kind of desperate stories that we are all familiar with from our healthcare system, you know, the people who have these inhumane scheduling systems that kind of defeat any attempts at family life or stability, you know, all these just-in-time scheduling systems. Is it your position that that's basically worth it for the world full of crap that capitalism creates?
So a couple things. The first is that those things, those horrors of working life, are a thing that are more common in poorer societies. So in that sense, yes, we are saying those things are, that the world full of crap corresponds to fewer of those things in the world. We are not saying that the world full of crap is contingent on those things. In fact, I think it is very likely that the next 20 years we'll see a heck of a lot more crap and a lot less of the kind of abusive practices that we hear about all the time that workers experience. That will be in part because of political advocacy. It will also be, though, because of the sheer raw wealth of our society. When we have more money, one of the luxury goods that we consume is moral goodness. We actually consume, I know it sounds crazy, go with me, guys, just for a hot second here. We in the United States, as we have gotten richer, we emit less. We are more conscious about our environmental footprint. That's something that we have the luxury to do because we're rich. And you see that in lots of other areas, I think.
But if that's true, I mean, the United States is richer than a lot of Scandinavian countries in terms of per capita income, but you have abuses of workers here, people being bankrupted by the healthcare system. You have people being bankrupted by childbirth that we don't have in countries that aren't as rich as us, but have just devoted themselves to a more equitable system.
So I think there's a couple things going on. One is that when people are richer, the benefits of that, the rapidity of change by which those riches make our lives tangibly better, changes from sector to sector. And I would argue in the United States that healthcare and education are two places that are heavily dominated by the public sector. These are not places where we have let the market get in and improve people's situations. We have not actually realized a system of free labor. People are much more trapped in a healthcare job or a government job or a teaching job than they are, I would argue, in a lot of other sectors.
Okay. So Taking again the example of Scandinavian social democracy, when you talk about socialism and particularly market socialism, how is that different than, I mean, how is the system that you're proposing different than just a generous European welfare state?
So I would say we start at a certain level thinking about what we want to see in a society. What are we against in capitalism? And I think, you know, socialists, especially those of us from Marxist backgrounds, like to have very scientific pretensions, right? It was called scientific socialism for that reason. But it's at core, it's a moral and ethical complaint. You know, we're against exploitation, we're against hierarchy. To whatever extent it can be abated, we want to see that sort of society. We've seen that the struggles of the workers' movement in much of Europe and in Scandinavia, but also elsewhere, have built welfare states that have given people a greater range of choice and opportunity. And we see that working. Now, this system also has a bit of an Achilles heel, though, because even though it put workers in a commanding position of power compared to almost anywhere else, it kept investment decisions in the hands of capitalists. And that allowed them to slowly undermine and erode all that was gained. That's why I think if you want a sustainable long-term socialism, then you need to really go beyond social democracy and socialize investment. Now, when it comes to markets or not markets, I mean, I want what works. I mean, I think this is something where we could say that given our experience based on the past of central planning, of course not, that model is broken. In the future, with computing, with other things, maybe a more participatory system would work. Or maybe we'll still have questions of calculations where we might need the market. To me, that's a question that has to be decided, not a priori, but in the process of struggle. But we do envision a society without class, a society after capitalism, not just socialism within capitalism.
So most of us, I think, would agree that you can't, you know, that capitalism kind of has to answer for the sins of actually existing capitalism, right? That you can't just talk about it as this theoretical abstraction. So why shouldn't the very well-documented horrors of communism impact how people think about the possibilities of socialism, and why shouldn't it make them wary about something that goes beyond just social democracy?
Well, I think at some level, of course, it should impact the thinking of any thinking person, right? Any history, any past experience, you can't ignore. It has to factor in. But, you know, in the same way that we, when we talk about reasons model, no one's here has mentioned Pinochet, no one's mentioned Franco, of course, because these are obviously different things. I think suffice to say, in the historical record of the 20th century, you've seen democratic experiments in socialism. You've seen movements that have attained great power, even state power, and honored and respected democracy while still extending social and economic rights from the workers' movement in places like Scandinavia or like in Sweden and Norway and a whole host of other places, including in Central America and Nicaragua, where the left movements have participated in peaceful transfers of power, that have participated in rule of law. And of course, you've also seen, in other instances, gross violations of people's dignity and rights. You've seen that on both sides. I think suffice to say that both socialism and capitalism are capable of democratic forms and authoritarian forms. But I don't think that people should keep these things out of their mind. I think it's important, but also I would say it is important to know that the democratic socialist tradition of the United States is longstanding, existed far before the Soviet Union, exists now afterwards, and many of these people were the most incisive and intelligent critics of Stalinism as a political system. In fact, our knowledge, even the word Stalinism, how we used to describe it, came in many ways from the democratic left.
You guys, one more question before we turn to the final proposition. But explain to me how a poor person in the United States, you know, going to a shitty public school, being born into substandard treated with substandard medical care, how is that person more free than a person born into a European country a poor person born into a European country with cradle to the grave welfare state?
Yeah, well, first off, we should recognize that they can move to America or they can come here. When we're talking about European democracies, we're talking about a place that is generally hostile to immigration, has been historically, continues to be. And I say this as somebody, I'm an open borders person. I think anybody who wants to come to the United States should be allowed to enter. And that's not a small thing. On the left, that is usually meant that I am somehow trying to stoke the reserve army of the unemployed to drive down wages so that capitalists can get more wealthy, even wealthier still, by having low wages. In fact, what it means is that people can come here and flourish in a way that Europe, because of socialism, and this is generally true, the higher the social welfare state, the more homogeneous the population tends to be, and they don't like immigrants. This is one of the reasons why Donald Trump is not merely stupid, but I think is profoundly evil. Even though he is within a few generations of emigrating, he would close off America. Many people on the left would do that as well, many people on the right. I think it's a big mistake. When you talk about what does it mean to be poor in America, you know, clearly there are people who are born in bad circumstances. The way that you fix that is not by starting to talk about democratic socialism and investing socially. It's that you free them from a public school system, which despite massive and ongoing increases in per pupil spending, never seems to help the people who need the help the most. You free them from that system, and I think this is why the libertarian movement has been very forward in the school choice movement, so that people have more choices within whatever limits are placed in front of them. You do the same thing with healthcare. You liberate the healthcare system from a place where 50 cents of every dollar is being spent by the government. It doesn't work very well. There is no reason why healthcare and education can't be delivered much more cheaply, much more innovatively by a flourishing free market. But, you know, to say why, wouldn't it be great if we were all born middle class in Denmark? Maybe. But that isn't the world we live in. The question is, we have the poor with us everywhere. How do we have fewer of them and how do we give them more options? And I would argue that's by limiting the government and providing a basic social safety net and then looking to civil society as well as kind of market socialism within those areas that we agree are going to be under public purview, like education and health care.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you one quick follow-up question, if that's okay. Because I mean, about immigration, it seems that the one thing that America actually has historically done better than most countries in Europe is integrate immigrants. And part of the backlash against immigrants in the European social democracies, right, is that people don't like paying all this money for people that they don't see as them. And the one thing that makes me despair about the social democratic system that otherwise seems ideal is that it seems to crack under the strain of diversity.
Oh, no, that's not true at all.
Okay.
Couple of points. First, let me say something because what Nick said is really, I think, important. He says that the healthcare system isn't working and what we need to do is free it up because we've seen that there's too much public money being spent on it. Public schools aren't working and what we need to do is free them up because they are clearly failing and we need to give people more choice by bringing markets in. This is important because too often in the United States, in these debates, when we find something in the public sector isn't working, the option always is to privatize and marketize. But here's the thing. Healthcare in Europe is provided at better quality, at lower costs, and with greater scope through the public system. It's not private healthcare. In American debates, I often, you know, I'm somebody come from another country, you wonder, do Americans know that the rest of the world exists? Okay, let's look at public schools. Yeah, public schools here are failing. That's because they've been choked. Because the funding to them has been choked, and there's a stealth privatization of public education because of the way that they're financed. The result, the option isn't to further privatize them so that the poor get trapped in these apartheid little neighborhoods of theirs in increasingly failing schools and all the kids with money get to leave. The option is to genuinely fund them, to actually give them money the way they're given money in other advanced industrial countries. The insistence on privatizing is a kind of extortion. that public support is off the table. So either you stay in the shit houses that we're giving you, or we privatize. And that's not a fair option, it seems to me.
Okay, now, if we're going to ask whether Americans know whether the rest of the world exists, then I think we should ask whether socialists know whether the rest of the world besides Denmark exists, where, again...
All right, let's talk. Let me.
Capitalism has improved the standard of living, including healthcare, dramatically.
Then let me answer your observation that the abuses that are going on in the workplaces in the United States are mostly something that occurs in poor countries and not in, so let's talk about these poor countries. Why do they occur in poor countries? Because poor countries today is what Victorian England was in the 19th century. The reason you don't see these abuses occurring in Europe right now isn't because there's something magical about rich countries. It's because in all these countries, there are trade unions, there are political parties that defend workers and which make it hard for employers to have the despotisms that they have in the United States. It is not about rich and poor. It's because in more developed countries, there's a history of trade unionism. The United States stands alone in having absolutely no protection from workers' organizations for those workers. And that's why the U.S. today is a parallel to what you're finding in poor countries. What these two zones of the world have in common is no protection for workers and the unbridled power of employers. That's why. Now, so that's not Denmark. That's the rest of the world.
What trade unions also stand up for, though, is they stand up for workers to the exclusion of people who would hope someday to be workers in our country. They stand up for
again,
workers
that's not true.
Against immigrants. They stand up for workers. This
actually,
is absolutely
the history
true.
Of internal migration.
They stand
migration.
Up for, against people who want to work for lower wages. They want to make that illegal. And those people otherwise don't have jobs at all. I honestly think that standing up for workers is an unexamined sentence that should be more closely examined because there are people whose interests are in opposition to workers who need our help.
I didn't hear all that. Let me just try to systematically answer what Michelle raised. And I'm sorry, I didn't hear everything you said, Catherine. It is true that in Europe right now, there is a kind of a backlash against immigration among certain sections of the population. But let's also keep something else in mind. The wave of migrants and immigrants who came out of the Middle East, Iraq and Syria, over the last 12 years, it's quite extraordinary how in Europe they were welcomed. Now, there has, in the midst of that, also been a backlash. That is not an artifact of social democracy. That's not an artifact of the welfare state. It is an artifact of the fact that since the establishment of the European Union, wages in Europe have stagnated now for more than 15 years. In Germany, England has gone through its worst period of wage stagnation. And what they're seeing when they look out into the world, what they see is that our mainstream parties, our own states are doing nothing to defend our wages while our benefits are being cut. The reason they point to the immigrants isn't because something about social democracy. It's because all of the establishment is telling them that there is nothing that we're going to do to improve your economic lot. Europe has been in an unrelenting austerity now for more than 15 years. The far right comes in and the far right says to them, here's why your wages are stagnating. It's because these people are coming in and taking it away. There's no other political party right now that's addressing the issue other than the far right. Until the last 10 years, immigration has not been an issue in Europe. It's become an issue right now because of the fact of the stagnating standards of living and that all is because of the increasing power of the right, the increasing power of corporations, and the increasing insecurity that the poor are feeling. That has nothing to do with social democracy per se. It has to do, once again, with the altered balance of power.
I think we have to move on to the final question, which is, as I said at the beginning, is capitalism the best way to improve standards of living, ensure political and economic freedom, and provide opportunity?
So before I respond, just very quickly, I want to thank Reason for participating. I sent Catherine an email at like noon with the rough idea, and she responded within a couple hours. You know, libertarians see market opportunities. I'll give them that. and thank you for the crowd for being, from both sides, being so respectful. I overheard some very nice conversation. You know, we're not liberals, but we like discourse. It's nice. Just please keep it there. I can't imagine what the offspring of a socialist and libertarian would be. Probably the most socially inept human being ever. So this question itself is a bit unfair. It's a bit too easy for us simply because we can't compare a theoretical system with a existing one in good faith, right? I could tell you that socialism would be way better. I can make all sorts of assertions, but that wouldn't be fair in a debate. What we can do is start with reality, where we are now, and then think about what a just society would look like. We think a just society would be one in which everyone is able to reach their potential. The socialist scientist Stephen Jay Gould used to say about Einstein that he was less interested and impressed with his brain than with the fact that people of equal talent lived and died in sweatshops and cotton fields. So if the system isn't allowing people to reach their potential, which I think we would all admit it isn't, but it's still filled with amazing wealth, but also exploitation and poverty and all sorts of terrible misery, then how could we make it better? We could try to tame the system at first. We could try to build a welfare state to try to get the basics at least. We're all unique and different, but we can all only develop these unique abilities in a society with a different sort of priority, a place where inequities are tackled so we all truly have a fair shot at life. This would mean at least a society should be able to socially provide people with the necessities, food, housing, education, I'm glad we already got Nick on one of them, healthcare, childcare, to allow for individual flourishing. And then we look again and we say, can we go further? Can we move beyond the welfare state into a more democratic, participatory society? This is an open question. We know that social democracy works. We also know its limits. Maybe we could go beyond it. I premised a lot of my work, a lot of my life on the idea that we can. But we do throw by testing, by pushing its boundaries. It's a democratic process that can move forward, but also one that can move backwards. I imagine in a capitalist society, there'll be plenty, socialist society, there'll be plenty of room for Nick and Catherine to have a party of 3-4% on the fringes of society. Honestly, it wouldn't be much of a change for any of us. But where we end up, wherever we end up, it won't be a utopia. It'll still be a place where you could get your heart broken. You might still be depressed. You might still feel lonely. It won't cure your stomach aches, your nausea, your indigestion, all that stuff. But in the process of getting there, I think we'll solve a few of our animal problems so we begin to start tackling our human ones. Socialists know that the old system isn't working, and we know that a democratic one, ordinary people could live freer and more fulfilling lives, is possible. That's the extent of the claims that I can make. And if you're interested in these ideas, I think you'll be part of a long, multi-generational movement, from Eugene Debs to Bernie Sanders, that'll perhaps one day make of the earth a homeland rather than an exile.
You know, it's funny what you said just now. Your system won't stop you from being heartbroken or lonely. It won't cure your heartburn or your stomach ache. Capitalism kind of does do those things, actually. I'm sure all of y'all have been on Tinder. I'm sure all of y'all have bought Pepto-Bismol. Those are the gifts of capitalism. And it sounds silly, but it's true. Capitalism, as it exists in the world, isn't perfect. I appreciate the extent to which we have managed to curb both of our impulses to compare real to imaginary and vice versa in this discussion. It's been an absolute pleasure, a rare one. And I think the place I want to wrap up is just to say that the virtues that capitalism fosters are not sexy ones, right? It is not struggle and martial courage and solidarity. The virtues that capitalism fosters are prudence and thrift and politeness. And like to be the guy who's fighting for politeness is not a sexy place to be, but I actually think it's the right place to be. A world in which people are fundamentally basically decent to each other because they're going to engage in voluntary market transactions to get the stuff they need, in which people can find love and cure their stomach ache and go down to the Duane Reade, hand over some money, hand over whatever you need, the double thank you in which everyone got what they wanted is an underrated miracle that capitalism has provided, that the free market enterprise system embedded in capitalism, embedded in modern liberalism has provided. And I think the idea of separating the crap from the broader system is misguided. The crap is the system, and the system is awesome. Now, again, it's not, as it exists in the real world, perfect. I will say that a million times over. Reason Magazine literally publishes 80 pages every month about how the current system is not the magical capitalist free enterprise system we would like to see. But what I want to say is that if we are trying to create a world where people can make their own choices about their own lives, capitalism does better than socialism, even than the wimpy kind of capitalistic socialism that these dudes keep flogging. And I think that the reason that's true is because it actually is a powerful force for bringing poorer people into more access to basic income, to fundamentals of life. Just because the rich people get richer doesn't mean the poor people aren't dramatically better off and freer under a capitalist system. That is what the last 20 years have shown. I think that's what the next 20 years can show, particularly in the developing world, if only we can let it.
Well, this really went by fast. I thought we were just getting warmed up. I really do. I want to thank, obviously, all of you who came here. Jason Farbman has not been mentioned yet, and he did incredible work. You may not know this, but for all of his radical talk, Bhaskar here is a capitalist because he runs a magazine, and Jason's one of his workers, so word to the worker. And for Michelle, of course, for being so kind and coming here. And okay, this doesn't go into my 3 minutes, by the way. Okay. All right. I'd like, if possible, for Nick to think about this and address this. Nick has said that capitalism, what it essentially is an implementation or operationalization of liberal political philosophy. And what I want to suggest is capitalism is completely inconsistent with liberal political philosophy. And if you really do take liberty and freedom seriously, you have to be a socialist. There's no way around that. And let me tell you why. The essence of liberal political philosophy is not the protection of property. This is something that was foisted onto it in the 20th century because of liberalism's fear of socialism. The essence of liberalism from the moment of its founding, with Rousseau, through Kant, through John Stuart Mill, the essence of it was to treat people as equals. The moral equality of human beings, not equal treatment, not to give them equal money, not to give them equal income, but to recognize the essential moral equality, the intrinsic worth of human beings. That's liberalism. Wait, it gets better. What capitalism is a system which systematically forces the subordination, the willing subordination of the majority of the population to an unbridled authority. That forces them to subordinate every other one of their longings for artistic expression, for love, for health, for whatever they want to do to the imperatives of the job. It systematically pits them against each other. It forces people to treat each other as means, not as ends. It forces every worker to see the other worker as a potential threat to his job. The question of immigration that Michelle brought in, and which Nick said, well, the left calls it the reserve army of labor. Yeah, well, it is. And that's not the left's fault. That's capitalism's fault. That when people are moving from one part of the world to the other, they are forced to view one another as rivals. There's nothing natural about that. That's how the labor market works. You cannot have a vision of the world in which you insist that people treat each other with respect, as Catherine correctly says, as moral equals, as liberalism enjoins us to, while you live in a system that is built on power, on hierarchy, on a Hobbesian war of all against all. That's the essence of capitalism. And what's motivated socialists from the start is to try to open up a space where people can have mutual respect, as Catherine says, where they can actually treat each other as ends, not as means, We have made progress in capitalism towards this. It's true. But all of that progress has come from battles of the poor, led by socialists, to try to tame these barbaric aspects of an inhuman system.
So the question was put that if I really wanted to take liberalism seriously, I would have to be a socialist. I don't think so. You know, I've thought it over, and Vivek, among other things, his history of liberalism is bizarre in that it doesn't actually begin with the beginning of liberalism, which predates Locke a couple hundred years before he was talking about, and it was about equality under the law. And it's very important to understand that what religious fighters in the English Civil War were fighting about is that we are all equal under the in the eyes of God, and so that a ruler doesn't have an absolute claim to any of our shit, especially our lives. And it's in that limitation of government power, of state power, or of the collective in the face or in the body of the king. That's where liberalism flows from. And it's about limiting government based on the idea that we are all ends in ourselves, not means to an end. And I would argue, obviously, that capitalism is the system that does a better job of actually implementing that vision. And it does it in a lot of ways by releasing us from, mobocracy, whether it's in the name of a king or in the name of the spirit of the age or anything like that. The fact of the matter is that capitalism, as we've been talking about it, and we can quibble with the definitions, you know, isn't perfect, and it does constantly need to be adjusted. One of the great things and what the left used to lament about capitalism before they started going back to talking about late capitalism rather than advanced capitalism, is that capitalism is infinitely malleable and it takes on all of this criticism and puts it into the system and it gives people more time off. By the way, kids didn't stop working because of Eugene V. Debs. Kids stopped working because technological innovation and capital production got to a point where we didn't need kids in order to grow food or to make socks or do all of the other stuff that we take for granted. We produce more stuff with less time and less resources. That's good for all of us. It gives us time to watch Netflix, which also is a product of capitalism, not of socialism. Our lives are getting better. Our food and our culture are getting better. Our lives are getting longer. This isn't accidental to capitalism. This is because of capitalism, of Whole Foods, of Netflix, of Amazon, of Apple, of dreadful pharmaceutical companies that in pursuing the profit motive mostly go out of business and go bankrupt, but every once in a while come up with Pepto-Bismol or antidepressants or all sorts of things, or Viagra, you name it. It's out there. The contraceptive pill was not a socialist fantasy. It was a capitalist reality, and it's a good thing. Capitalism helps us grow, it helps us energize ourselves and live our life to a fuller potential. What we do need is not to debate capitalism, but to take the wheels off of things. We need to stop shooting wars, and we need to stop wars on drugs. We need to allow people to be more free, not just from the state, but from society in a way that says, we don't like the way that you want to live. We don't like the way you look. We don't want you to live there, and get rid of those impediments, which come primarily from the state and vested interests, certainly not from capitalists who are happy to sell anybody, anywhere, anything they want.
Thank you so much. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you.
This has been the Reason Podcast. Thanks for listening. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.